What is going on, everybody? And welcome back to another episode of The Bog right here on Dave Martell D-Live Channels. Our first ever time on D-Live. So many thanks. I see my boy Verbo, Mother Hen, you know, both gifting with a diamond. I don't know what that means yet, but it sounds pretty great. The diamond's worth a lot of money, sort of. But anyway, thank you very much to both of you guys for the generous donations, and we're going to get started. We got a really, really good episode tonight, one that's a little bit controversial, and we're going to get right into it. I don't know what you do here. Do you like, subscribe, share like you do on YouTube? Whatever it is, you know, let's do that. So people that are subscribing, whatever. So appreciate everybody tuning in here on D-Live. We're going to be here from now on because we're tired of Google taking all of our money. So we're done with that. I will later on upload these shows to be premiered on YouTube for all the schlubs that don't want to come over here to the Cool Kids Club over here in D-Live. But that's all right. So we have a really great show here tonight. But before we get started, I want to give a couple shout-outs, a couple plugs right here. Time's running out. Epicist Magazine, get issue 1 before issue 2 comes out on Ostara. On Ostara, issue 2 comes out. It's going to be great. It's going to be great. So make sure you get caught up with issue 1 of the Epicist Magazine, available on Amazon.com. Type in the Epicist Magazine or Neurona Society or something. You'll find it. A couple more plugs real quick. Also from Neurona Society, make sure you get a copy of Odin's Wife by William Reeves. Tremendous, tremendous book. And then also The Otis Book by Mark Perrier. This has to be on your bookshelf. Absolutely tremendous read when talking about the Germanic tradition and our ancestral spirituality. But talking about ancestral spirituality, we have, like I said, a really controversial topic tonight. Not really controversial. You know, me and Tristan are going to dig into this. And before I say this, we have, you know, we're not taking a swipe at anybody who is a perennialist. We're not taking a swipe at anybody that's from the capital T traditionalist school of thought. So if you really love Julius Evola, we're not, you know, taking a swipe at, you know, for example, a guy that we really, really like and we're friendly with, an acquaintance of ours, the Mighty Tom from Survive the Jive. I believe I'm pretty, at least perennial, he's hard perennial leaning, this guy. But we really like the guy, and we trust, we know that somebody like him isn't going to take this personal or anything like that. You know, I have to do this disclaimer because a lot of times when you do critiques of ideologies, like people out there on the internet take it personal and they get all mad. But we know Tom, being the inquisitive mind that he is, he will, if he sees this, and I know he tunes into the ball quite a bit, that he'll be like, you know, yeah, this is an interesting critique that you guys are doing. You know, he'll look at it intellectually. And, you know, I would like everybody that is a perennialist to take Mr. Tom's lead and look at it intellectually. Look at this as an intellectual critique, a philosophical critique, because that's really what this is a philosophical critique. So I'm going to quit running my mouth. Mr. Tristan, tell us, what is perennialism?
Right, and we'll actually get into some of the definitions here in a moment, but to talk about Tom Rousseau at the Survive the Jive, we've discussed the issue of perennialism between us, and I believe, I could be mistaken, but I believe that he only holds the view that perennialism functions within the Indo-European tradition. So that is a bit adjacent to what, you know, the main definitions of perennialism would imply here.
Okay, yeah.
So it might not even apply to him. I mean, who knows? He'll have to say himself for sure.
Yeah,
but,
absolutely. Maybe we'll get him on the show to talk about it one of these days. That'll be a good,
absolutely,
episode. He's always a great guest. So, Mr. Tristan, there are two different sort of definitions or understandings when approaching the perennialist school of thought. One is a classical one, and one is a more contemporary version. Can you kind of tell us what those are?
Right. We'll start with the classical one that derives from an understanding of the Platonic philosophy from the Greco-Roman days. And it centers around an idea called Prisca Theologia, which is literally ancient theology. And it is the doctrine that asserts that a single true theology exists, which threads through all religions and which was anciently given by God to man. And this is really important to understand when we're talking about Platonism, that Platonism implies the existence, or outright states the existence, of a single absolute monotheistic deity, the one, right? Like the Christian God. You know, Platonism is very compatible with Catholicism. There is a very Thomistic school of thought there. So in this view, they have the idea that, you know, way, way, way back at the beginning of time, more or less, or human, you know, religious understanding, God, in a monotheistic sense, gave humanity the actual true religion, and that ever since then, all the other religions have just been like some corrupt, debased form of the one true religion. And which is why they have a sort of universalist understanding that all religions contain aspects of the truth that was originally found within this one religion, but that, you know, it could differ between religions. Some religions might be more pure and some might be more corrupted.
So, are you implying that perennialism is implying, are you implying that perennialism is implying that this monotheistic view, or is perennialism a more nuanced version of that? Because I know a lot of perennialists sort of call themselves monists.
Yeah, monism is very popular in the Platonic school. So if you're using the classical definition, you basically have to assume a sort of monotheistic setup. Or at least a setup in which a religious exclusive setup, like there is one true faith that has a god.
Okay, so that's the more classical understanding of it, correct?
Yeah, that is.
And what would be the more, because I know everybody's familiar with Julius Evola, a lot of people, this is a little bit more obscure, but like René Guénon, there's a few other authors out there, I can't remember off the top of my head, but those are kind of like the big guys, especially Julius Evola. He's like the at least in our circles, he's the more popular one. What would be the definition for perennialism within the more contemporary stuff like Julius Evola?
Right, that would be the definition found in the traditionalist school of thought, which is very, very similar, but I'll explain in a second exactly how it differs. The actual definition would be that it is a popular interpretation that argues for universalism under the idea that all religions, underneath their seeming differences, point to the same truth. And the difference is that in the classical Prisca Theologia view, that there was originally a single religion in which the modern religions are like corrupt manifestations of it, like a mirror. Whereas in the traditionalist perspective, all religions are actually trying to say more or less the same thing. They don't all derive from a single truth, but they're all coming towards a single truth. It's almost like the exact opposite end of the spectrum. But as you can see, it is very similar. They end up in more or less the same respects.
Very cool. So how is this now? How does this like pertain to, because, you know, we very much believe in objective truth. You know what I mean? We believe, you know, some people would say that what you're describing is objective truth. Are they the same thing or are they completely different?
They're a bit ancillary to one another. You can have an objective truth that does not imply a universal single religion. For instance, in the Germanic faith specifically, we would recognize an objective truth centered around natural law, around Orlog.
Yeah.
That is true for everyone. It doesn't matter if you're, you know, Chinese or, you know, Mexican or Scandinavian. We all still live in the same reality. We're, you know, we operate under the same basic laws of reality.
Yes, exactly.
You know, the Chinese don't run slower and also happen to win the race. It just never happens, right?
Yeah. Yeah, so it's something like gravity, for example. Gravity applies to everybody. It's not necessarily a religious thing. It is a religious thing, but, you know, it's not necessarily all religious
right.
things.
Right, it's just part of the metaphysics of the reality we all inhabit.
Yeah, so...
But the difference there would be that within that setup, we can still have different religions. For instance, our gods gave the religion to the Indo-European people exclusively, is at least what I would believe, so that you cannot be part of our religion and be Chinese.
Yeah.
But that doesn't imply that our gods are the only gods or that Chinese people don't have their own religion that is just as valid.
So
at least for them, anyway.
Now, what would you say to somebody that says, well, you know, if you guys have truth and then they also have truth, how is it that it's not a perennial truth, or how does that parallel with an objective truth?
Well, the difference here would be, I mean, it kind of depends on exactly which definition of perennialism you're going for. If we're going for the classical one, then we would have to have the argument that both of the religions share a common origin, which we know anthropologically is just simply not the case.
Yeah.
You know, like through comparative religious study, we know that contrary to what the ancient people believed, most religions just aren't actually that similar. And the similarities they thought were there was because they were seeing a common Indo-European root that they didn't know existed.
Yeah. So now that we kind of got this laid out, what perennialism is, let's get on to some like critiques of it and our criticism of it. Because a lot of us, especially in the Setian path, are we ascribe to kind of like a budding idea that's in our circles called primordialism, which is sort of like, you know, objectivism. And it's sort of like the replacement of perennialism with something that is more coherent to a Germanic worldview. Would you agree with that, Tristan?
I mean, I guess you would have to give me a very hard definition of what primordialism is, because as you said, it's very nascent, it's sort of vague, and I mean, depending on exactly what you could believe, I might disagree or agree with it, but I would agree that we should replace it with a native objective understanding of Orlog, but that we have to reject universalism of religion, and we have to stay in a focused position as accorded by the Germanic faith.
Okay, so that's I'm seeing that looks like no, it's good. My screen's good. So, yeah, we'll actually do a whole show talking about primordialism. If we do a show about primordialism and we don't have Jack Young on, he's gonna be pissed. So we're gonna wait until we have him on. But we'll do a whole we'll dedicate a whole show to that. So you just mentioned something that's very, very crucial in this, the entirety of this show, and the entirety of Indo-European and specifically Germanic spiritual tradition, and that is folkism, and that our religion applies to us and doesn't apply to, say, you know, the Chinese or, I don't know, Kalahari Bushmen or, you know, some Mesoamerican. It doesn't apply to them. You know, why?
Well, in the Germanic faith, it has to do with an understanding of the metaphysics of the soul. We understand our soul as having derived literally, hereditarily from the gods. From in the Rig's Tula, Rig comes and sleeps with a woman and produces the caste of society and accepts Jarl as his son. Now, this accepting of his son is a very specific moment in Germanic culture, because our ancestors believed that a person did not inhabit the clan and possess the clan well of souls until their father picked them up, inspected them, and literally claimed them as their son and gave them a name. So in the Rig Tula, when it says that Rig claimed him and called him son and gave him the name Jarl, this is him literally giving to him his soul from his own lineage, his clan well of souls. Now, as anyone who can read the Rig's Tula might imply, that it's not exactly talking about Chinese or black people. It's very ethnocentric. And because of that, we know that all of the Indo-European faiths had a very strong patrilineal idea. We'll go on to it in at later sections to talk about the Hindu understanding, which also does confirm this. But our ancestors believed that in order to be part of the tribe, to be part of the Herios, which is what the ancient term for Aryan was, is that you had to be a son of the tribe. So your father had to be one of the tribe. If your father was some foreigner and your mother was part of the tribe, then you could not be part of the tribe.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's very much a patrilineal. So what do you think about the people that are just purely folkish, and they think that the only kind of door you need to go through to be of this faith is just be broadly European? Or do you think those people are correct?
No, I don't. I think it's a very tricky situation to fall into, because it, you know, like it looks on the face of it like it might be correct. Obviously, if your father's was Germanic, then you're probably going to be racially Germanic. That's just how that works out. But they think they're falling into the trap of profane racial materialism. We're talking about the metaphysics of the soul is how people decide adherence to the gods and lineage from them. And the racial materialism might often follow the same route, but it's not exactly the same thing.
Yeah. I actually did a video a while back called Racialism is Anus Worship. And everybody like spurred out on me because I don't even think most of them even watched the video. They just saw the title because it was an inflammatory title. And they got really, you know, upset about it. But the point that I was trying to make was, look, it's not, you know, your folk soul. what your claim to this religion isn't just that you have, you know, light brown or blonde or red hair or green or blue eyes or whatever. That's not, you know, your physical expression is not what is the claim. The claim is what is your soul, because your physical expression is part of your soul. It is the expression of your soul that is passed down patrilineally from the gods. You know what I mean? So it's not that necessarily that, you know, having, it's, okay, so it's ethnocentric on a metaphysical level, on a much deeper, more hardcore level, is pretty much what it is.
No, I think that is exactly the right way to look at it.
Yeah.
As I say, Odin doesn't live in a gene somewhere.
No, our genes are expressions of our soul. So let's move on to kind of some of the... you have in the notes, speaking of ethnocentrism, in the notes here, he has examples of Germanic pagan intolerance toward foreign faiths. Let's go through that a little bit.
Right. Okay. The first one I have here is from The Passion of Saint Saba the Goth, which broadly talks about the a peasant of the Gothic people in the 4th century in Europe. And he was a Christian, had been converted, even though most of the Gothic people at that time were currently pagans. And The Passion is basically the story of his life, in which he was eventually recognized by the Catholics as a saint. So, and it says, and I quote, "In circa 369, the Tervingi king Athanaric began a persecution of the Christians in his territory. First, a Gothic nobleman began the suppression of Christianity in Sabas's area. When his agents came to the village where Sabas lived, they forced the village to eat pagan sacrificial meat, which in our modern religious understanding, we would be under the knowledge that they made them perform bloat, effectively."
Yeah. Also,
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, early Christianity was a lot of them were vegetarian. A lot of people don't realize that.
Well, yeah, they also had specific compunctions against eating any sort of pagan meat that was used in sacrifice. They were not allowed to do this. And it actually, in Europe, it got so widespread that Christians banned the consumption of horse meat because horses were so commonly sacrificed by our ancestors in that fashion.
Yeah. And this also goes against the whole, like, victim complex that the poor puppy dog pagans of Europe got pushed around and bullied by the big bad Christians. When, in fact, we'll
get there.
and also the idea that, that we were these victims and the Christians came in, pushed us around, and we were just these peaceful traders. It's that narrative is literally copy and paste from like what they say about indigenous people. You know what I mean?
That narrative of we're pagans, so we don't make you worship in a specific way, and we don't care what your religion is. We're super tolerant. Well, as we're about to see in the next session, know that that is not the case.
No,
that wasn't the case for our ancestors in any case.
No, it was the pagan versus Christian part of Europe, and I'm going to be very clear about this. I have no issue with my pagan brother or my Christian brothers and sisters, as long as they are tolerant of me and they want to shake hands with me. And they're good people, good moral people. I have no issue. And also, if they have genuine, authentic belief in their religion, I'll shake hands with you. I will have respect for you and stuff like that. But let's be honest about the past here. It was a war, and we fought each other, and we killed each other, and spilled blood, and forced stuff on each other, forced laws on each other. We didn't get along. It was a nasty war, and there was violence and aggression and oppression on both sides. And I'm not sorry, and I don't expect you to be sorry. So I'm just going to throw that out there. You know?
Right, and that's another episode we might want to do at some point. The idea of the religious traditionalist alliance would be a very good one.
Yeah.
But anyway, to go back to the Passion of Saint Saba the Goth, the next section reads, "In the year 372, Sabas celebrated Easter with the priest Sansilas. 3 days after Easter, Athared, the son of the Atharic sub-king Rothithius, arrived in the village to arrest Sansilas. Sabas was dragged naked through thorn bushes, then racked alongside the priest Sansilas to a wagon wheel and whipped. The next day, he was offered pagan sacrificed meat again. He was, however, still steadfast and suggested that they tell Athelred to kill him.
Yeah, you gotta give it to him.
So here we can see that, Sansalas here was the priest that Sabath was friends with. And the Athelrics were so intolerant and angry at him for trying to convert the villages that they had him put onto a wheel and whipped and starved.
I guess that's not funny, but that's.
Well, I mean, like as you were saying, it just so destroys the narrative about this like peaceful, tolerant, pagan, like hippie thing.
Yeah, no, it's complete garbage. Our ancestors were warriors. They were completely intolerant. They, they pushed people around, and they didn't have, you know, tolerance for foreign ideas being in their lands and stuff. And they fought the idea of Christianity when it came.
Right, Cyprosity here in the chat is saying, what about St. Boniface after he cut down the Donar oak, the Irminsul?
That was a jerk-off move.
Which I have to say, St. Boniface immediately went down, like he fled the country because he was in so much danger and went to Frisia, I believe it was, on one of the islands there. And the second he stepped off the boat, he met a Norseman with an axe who planted it in his face and killed him.
Yeah, so that's what you get, man, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it really does destroy the entire narrative about that peaceful hippie pagan thing, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, we see, I mean, there was literally a war of conversion. I mean, people were lying and killing each other and doing all kinds of underhanded tricks. And when things got done to them, they responded with, like, extreme violence. You know, the good old-fashioned ultra-violence.
Yeah. And I want to give a special shout to Roots. You donated 14 lemons. Many thanks to you, sir. And many thanks to everybody. Much love to my people, Rory.
Yeah, I don't know what any lemons actually mean yet, but however much that was, thank you.
Yeah, whatever it is, we love it. And to the Verbo gang, Rory and Mother Hen for hosting and bringing some more viewers in. Much love to both you guys, man. I love you guys. That's my fam right there. So let's keep going.
Right, we have here the right, we have the life of Ansgar, who was a I think he was Saxon in the German sense. He was a German Saxon who was trying to convert people in Norway or Sweden, I can't remember which. But anyway, it says Ansgar's biographer Rimbert, in his Vita Ansgari, the life of Ansgar, relates that the archbishop arrived to Birka after having sailed for 20 days. The year is not certain, but seems to have been 851 or 852. There he found that King Olaf and a large part of the people were affected by a pagan counter-movement. A seer asserted that he had participated in the council of the Aesir, who had expressed their dissatisfaction with the Christian god. In case the current gods were not sufficient to the people, the gods decided to accept the former King Eric Bjornsson, in their abode. The seer's vision was widely believed. A sanctuary was built in the honor of the long-deceased Eric, and people performed sacrifices to him. So here we can see a very specific historical reference that goes against the sort of universalistic undercurrent of perennialism, that this seer asserted, and everyone in the community believed him, including the king, that the Aesir were very dissatisfied with the Christian God. They did not like him. They did not like people converting to the faith or having anything to do with the religion.
Yeah. That's it just blows out so many narratives right now. Just these two paragraphs here. It's pretty incredible. But as far as like universalism though, it's like, you know, how is it that people that pretend to be part of our faith like try to invoke this universalist stuff? It's like right in your face that it's not even there's like I don't even say that I'm folkish, because if you say that you're of the Germanic tradition, it just implies that you're folkish. You just there's no other
right. I mean that's kind of the way I go about it too. Like people who are universalists, I don't consider them to be part of the faith at all. Like I don't even recognize their claims. They have pretensions to the faith.
Yeah. So then you also have some evidence of Dharmic religious intolerance as well, that they also had.
I would say it's closer to religious specificism, but it does very much contrast with the sort of universalist perennial outlook. So according to the Rig Veda, the Dasyus are regularly the enemies of the Aryas, the Aryan people, and the poets repeatedly ask the gods' help against them. Rig Veda 10:22:8 lays out the character of the Dasyu according to the Rig Vedic poems. He is a Karaman of non-deeds, that is, he does not perform the sacrificial rites. He is a Bantu of non-thought, because he does not know the truths formulated in the Vedic hymns, and therefore is unable to articulate these truths. And he is Anyavrata, one whose commandments are other than the commandments of the gods. And he is Amanusa, no son of Manu, and therefore one who does not belong to the Vedic people. So very clearly here, they are delineating a foreign people who do not perform the sacrificial rites correctly. That is, there is an incorrect way to perform them. They do not have the same philosophical truths as we do, and therefore, you know, there is a wrong understanding, there's a wrong belief system in them. Their gods command things other than our gods, so they cannot be the same gods. And that they are literally no son of Manu, that they are linearly not part of our people.
So what are, it's talking about the Dasyus or whatever. How do you,
right, the Dasyu are a, in this instance, they're referred, there is some controversy about what exactly the Dasyu meant in the Vedic period. It goes between an actual tribe that might have lived, which might be the Dasae, or it is a type of demonic people that are, the Vedas specify as having lived in the area prior to the, Or during the, you know, like the conquest and the great subjugation of India. I want to backtrack there. I don't mean to imply the Indo-Aryan invasion theory there, but, you know, during the time in which the Indian culture and the religion was being spread and, you know, promulgated officially throughout the land.
But isn't, you know, Aryan invasion theory true, though?
No. I mean, it is very... from the European perspective, it is almost irrelevant to make a difference, but it is relevant to note that the migration theory is considered the currently accepted one, in which the Aryan people did come from outside of India. They came from the Urheimat and traded down, but they didn't just conquer and kill and subjugate all the native inhabitants. They more migrated into it and sort of assimilated them into it. Which is very different from what happened in Europe. Like, when our ancestors came to Europe, they basically fucked over everyone. They killed all of the males and took the women. That's where the idea of the Aryan invasion theory come from, because we assumed, well, like, well, they must have done the same thing, right?
Yeah. Dang. So, now I want to kind of touch on that a little bit about, the Indo-European invasion into Europe. A lot of people, there's a lot of, like, you know, these Varg types that think that, Indo-Europeans have been in Europe for, you know, 80 gorillion years or whatever. We were previously Neanderthals and, like, all of this stuff.
I remember it, reincarnation.
Yeah. but. So that was what Tristan's talking about here is that was his argument for his.
Right. That was what Varg said about when questioned about how he might know any of these practices. I think it was specifically about the bear cult.
Yeah. He said he remembered it through genetic memory. It's like, all right. Well, anyway.
My wife's placenta or something, you know, whatever he came up with.
Yeah. Either way, but like those kind of guys, what their theory is that Europeans have been in Europe for 14 gorillion thousand years, and that's it. But in actuality, the Indo-Europeans, us, moved in there and, like, slaughtered everybody and knocked up all the women and then, like, took over. Like, it wasn't really...
Right, and, I mean, anyone who has, you know, followed me in the Nirona Society in our chats have probably seen me get very specific about the point over and over again that the Stone Age Europeans are not our ancestors. It's a very common mistake people make because they just think that, you know, like, Europeans, that must be us. But our ancestors, in the patrilineal sense, arrived to Europe about 4,000 years ago, and they proceeded to literally massacre the entire indigenous people and then took all their women and, like, slave bred with them and constructed a power hierarchy on top of it. And it was such a complete and utter devastation that We don't know what these people, we don't have anything, no, any knowledge of their language. We don't know anything about their culture. We don't know what religion they had. And I believe in the closest genetic study I've seen is in the Netherlands. They are down to 2.5% of the population can be patrilineally traced back to them. Like they were utterly massacred. They basically don't exist anymore.
Now, Rory says, we are so intermixed with the Beaker people, we are practically the same. What do you think about that?
Well, I believe the Beaker people were themselves Indo-Europeans.
Yeah, he's talking about the
I
Bell
might have to look
Beakers.
that up.
Yeah, he's talking about the Bell Beakers. Yeah, I'm not 100% sure about it, because I know there's the Bell Beaker people, you had like the Stone Axe people, and then you also had what else were they called? There's another one there. The Corded Ware. You know, so you had a few different peoples that are identified by their material culture that lived in that region at that time. That some of them were that you're referring to were already Indo-European. So it's not that we intermixed with some of those peoples, is that those people were the result of Indo-Europeans. But I'll tell you what, the Neolithic farmers, they built Stonehenge. So that's like all we
Right,
have
and it
left.
does have to be noted that even when we go back to like, the Stone Age and whatnot in Europe, that there are three distinct population groups. There're the Neolithic farmers, as you mentioned, that were coming up from the south. Then there's the indigenous hunter-gatherers from the north, and then there are the steppe folk, which is what patrilineally the Indo-European people derive from. And specifically amongst the Germanic people and Scandinavians, we are mostly from the steppe folk and the hunter-gatherers with a small amount of farmer admixture. But absolutely, we did not just assimilate into these people. We utterly conquered them, destroyed their societies, and very small numbers of their men ever survived. Like, we just took their women, basically.
That's pretty brutal.
Oh, it was absolutely brutal.
Yeah.
And we dominated so much because the Indo-European people created the idea of cavalry. Like we broke the horses and domesticated them. That was kind of our thing.
Yeah, the
And
chariot.
we just militaristically stomped over everyone else.
Yeah, that is why, you know, the chariot was the that was like the flagship achievement of the Indo-European peoples. That's why the Indo-European peoples were so so good at conquering, because they had that technology of the chariot, and because of that, there's so much wheel imagery in everything. Look at like everything from the swastika to the sun wheel to the Sedian wheel. You know, there's so many wheels. Why? Because of chariots. Well, at least that's the material argument of it.
Right, and in the chat, Sonar Bretland say, weren't the Dasa mentioned in the Rigveda also very dark-skinned? No, not specifically. That comes from a mistranslation of the Vedic text in which they're referred to as dark in the sense of like evil and demonic, and it's been mistranslated as like dark-skinned. But that's not actually accurate to the original text.
Now, Legionary says Poseidon is likely the single remnant of their religion. I do recall there was a show previously where we discussed, there was kind of like a, it just popped up in conversation. I pointed out a possible cognate between Poseidon and Njord. Do you remember that?
Yeah, I do remember that. And I've had a bunch of work myself on the origins of Poseidon. I would have to refresh myself to really talk about it in depth, but from what I recall, the name Poseidon comes from a female deity that was something of the sort like Poseidia. But Poseidon himself, all of the attributes about him are very thoroughly Indo-European, and he has cognates ranging from Njord, Freyr, Agni, all these different sorts, or even as a tripartite deity with Zeus, which, as we know, was the Indo-European deity par excellence, Deopater.
Yeah. So what he's talking about with the Deus Pitar or whatever is the Sky Father, saying that, you
Right, Skyfather.
know, a lot of folks aren't familiar with that term. I mean, I guess most people are at this point, you know, since Indo-European comparative research has gotten pretty popular over the past few years.
Well, see, it's very easy to understand because the name basically stayed the same throughout the Indo-European expansion there. It's literally Deus, like God, to, like a deity, Deus Pater, as in father, Pater, father.
Yeah. So Now, a lot of people will say that Zeus comes from the word Deus Pater. You know what I mean? Comes
right.
from the word
from Jupiter comes from Deu Pater, literally, you know, Godfather.
So, what about Odin?
Odin is also derived from the Sky Father, which is something that some people, you know, don't really seem to get on because a lot of the main attributes of Odin that they recognize aren't the same kind of attributes. But if you go through like the names of Odin through the poetic sources, a bunch of his names derive from things like the roaring, the rumbling, the growler, the storm wind, that sort of thing. All these storm attributes that were associated with the Sky Father.
Yeah. And he who makes
and of course,
sound.
The Sky Father was also a lord of victory in battle and, you know, literally the lord of the hosts, you know, the armies.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So, yeah, that's so I take it you're not a fan of the Tiwaz Sky Father.
No, I very much reject that idea. I take the position that Tiwaz does derive linguistically from the same source as Deus Pater, but it was meant as a title. Like, you know, the word Tyr meant brave or as a generic term for a god. For instance, a bunch of Odin's names also have the word Tyr into it. He is Hengatyr, literally the hanged god. Veratyr, god of the world. The deity we know as Tyr probably has a proper name that's been lost, and we just only understand the word Tyr now. Kind of like how Freyr isn't actually the deity's name. It means Lord. His name is Yngvi.
Yeah. Now, I was in a chat of like before the show, and somebody was making the argument that Yngvi and Freyr were not the same person.
Oh, no, I would totally reject that argument, though you kind of can make one in the sense that the Germanic sources only recognize Ing or Yngvi. But I think it's, I don't think it's a very good argument because the name Yngvi and the Ynglings are also recorded from the Germanic source, clearly in reference to Freyr.
Yeah. Legionary says sometimes the splitting and merging of Deus Pater and the Thunderer still confuses him.
Right, and that is something that happens mostly in the, you know, like in the Greek sense, but it does kind of happen later on in the Hindu sense, though. Indra is very different in the sense of Zeus, because the Hindu sources have a sort of different chronology in their texts, where it's almost much later than ours are. And in their chronology, the Thunderer, in this case Indra, has already taken kingship from his father, who has retired. Whereas in our chronology, Zeus Deus Pater Odin is still very much ruling, and Thor is not the Lord.
Okay, so let's take a step back into perennialism now that we kind of touched on some Indo-European comparative stuff, some comparative myths. You mentioned earlier in the show about our boy survived the jive. He is sort of a perennialist. And you said you think he has the position of that it's only within the Indo-European traditions. How much, you know, does perennialism get into syncretism? And how much perennialism within the Indo-European traditions is authentic without it being, you know, syncretism?
Right. And I mean, that is a very tough decision to really delineate on, you know, hard lines and whatnot. I would say personally that I believe all of the deities in the Indo-European peoples all refer to the same original deities, like Zeus and Odin and, any of the other Sky Father figures are actually the same deity. Like, it's not some other deity that's kind of like that, that's been brought off to the side. But syncretism in the aspect of just combining traditions like willy-nilly is the wrong way to go about it, I feel. I think the different branches of the Indo-European people were meant to be separate. They wouldn't have been separate if it was not the will of the gods in order to do this. And that it is almost a sort of classical hubris in order to try to say, well, I know better than what the gods have decided, and I'm going to do it however I want.
Yeah, our boy Soner has an interesting take here. He has got a good question, actually. What would Freya's real name be? Freya means lady, yes?
Yes, it does. Freya does mean lady. We don't really know what Freya's name might have been. I've seen some suggestions for Ingwine or Ingwine, something of that sort, as a sort of female parallel of Yngwie, which does make sense. Though the original, like the, if we go back to the cognate deities of what Freya would be associated with, we find that they come to the word prithvi, which means it was Indo-European. It means to love, and it's found in also Aphrodite as well, and also the one of the Hindu deities. I forget which one exactly. So it's one of the wives of the Trimurti. I believe it's Vishnu's wife.
Very interesting. And then, is there anything in the sources? Because I know Wynn here says he doesn't know if that name is recorded anywhere, unfortunately, talking to Sonar. So the Ingwine, or the feminine version of Yngwie, is that found anywhere, or is that just kind of a
No,
suggestion?
that's straight up just a linguistic reconstruction. It is unfortunately not found anywhere what her name might have been. And this is probably due to some sort of taboo against actually just saying, the name of the lady. You might get away with that against with talking to Freyr because he's a man. You can more speak to him on his level, but it would be almost disrespectful to refer to Freya as by her given name.
Yeah. Well, because titles were absolutely important, and it was considered disrespectful. And it was even you know, this goes into this kind of destroys the narrative of our ancestors didn't fear the gods. They feared the gods certainly, and this kind of goes into it that they didn't name them. In fact, that they thought that if they named them, maybe they would summon them to be angry. I've read that the word bear was not, the original word for that animal. That was like a title. I forget what it mean. I think it means, I
It
can't
means
remember.
the brown one.
The brown one, that's right. So they didn't use the real name of the creature because they feared that it would summon these bears.
And it is very much the same in Nordic sources when talking about the gods. You've seen them refer to the gods by kennings and titles and poetic allusions because they didn't want to, grab the gods' attention. You see this especially with Odin, which could be very dangerous to just grab his attention suddenly. Because if the gods see you and you're just like messing around or something, they could be very angry, but also they could demand things of you for attracting their attention and wasting their time.
Yeah, exactly. And so our ancestors were absolutely God-fearing people, gods-fearing people. They weren't the people, I don't kneel, I'm not scared, I'm on equal footing with the gods. Which is, when you say, if you said that to a Hindu, they'd be like, are you out of your mind? Like, you're on equal footing
Right.
with the gods. Are you crazy? Yeah, so Soner, one more
I mean,
from.
it is a very hubristic, and I mean, it's literally in the Greek term a classical hubris to believe that you are equal to the gods. And
Yeah.
they have lots of myths in which people believe this, and then they come down and then bitch slap the fuck out of you. Like Athena once turned someone into a spider because they thought they were equal to the gods.
Yeah. And one more from the chat. Our boy Soner again. He's got some good comments tonight. He says, also, thoughts on the Frigg Freya dichotomy. There are lots of people who say they're the same, and Frigg means beloved.
Right, and we did cover this a bit during when we had William Reeves on to talk about his book Odin's Wife. Personally, I do take the basis that Frigg and Freya are the same deity and should be worshipped as such. I do believe that this is correct. And I've gone back and forth with William on the subject. We have a very respectful theological disagreement on the matter.
Yeah, I am. I'm still not convinced. I still think that they're separate. Not that I have any evidence, but Frigg is my patron deity. So,
Well, and I don't mean to imply that there isn't evidence to the contrary. I just think that the evidence that Frigg and Freya are the same are more consistent and overwhelming, I guess we should say. It is legitimately a theological disagreement. I don't mean to imply that the opposite position is some sort of like heresy or anything.
no, it's they're both respected positions, and definitely worthy of debate. But My position is that they are different. I don't have any evidence for it. That's just what I feel in my heart, because I have been praying to Frigg for so long, and I just believe that they're separate deities. Just because of what I, you know, that's just personal gnosis. That's not anything I could pull up a source on. And he says that Frigg means beloved. It's been a minute since I read Odin's Wife. So I suggest anybody that's interested to learn more about the All-Mother Frigg, read Odin's Wife. Frigg is actually cognate to the word Frau. You know what I mean? It has a lot to do
with... Right. Frigg and Freya linguistically come from the same source. That's one of my main arguments for them being the same deity, is that it's basically the same word.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the argument. And if you look at the All-Mother throughout all of Europe, you know, she's called not just Frigg, but she's called Frau Berta, Frau Bershta. She's Frau in most of the Germanic lands. She's Frau something, and then she's also Frigg. Yeah, so.
Well, also in the Germanic source, she's literally Freya, literally, you know, the beloved. I believe it was North Saxon tales.
Yeah.
Which, as we know, I mean, there is no like other deity that might be Freya in that sense. There's only Freya, who is the wife of Odin.
Yeah. Hugar says, I'm wondering if Odin was Odin's original name, but rather a sort of nickname, similar to how Bear means the brown one.
He does actually say as much in the Grimnismal, I believe, in which he has a very long exposition about how he had all of these different names, and he used to be called this and this, and he says, and I quote, now am I Odin, Thund was I once, something of that sort. But he does say, especially, now am I Odin. So it could be the case that he wasn't originally named Odin.
And that's a title that has just taken the place of the name, and his true name has been forgotten.
Yeah, more or less. Though, linguistically, I do have to take the position that the word Odin does derive from the term Wotanas, which, I mean, it does show a very ancient root all the way back to the Proto-Germanic. But as I said, you know, I do believe that Odin is the Sky Father, and obviously Odin is not the same word as Dupater. So, I mean, we could see that obviously the name differs. And Odin himself says that I've never had a single name for as much as I've been among man.
Yeah. And I want to dispel something real quick here. There's a... there is a kind of like a goofy theory that's been going around that Odin is a new deity or a construct of Christianity or just like something like that. Well, if you look through all Indo-European traditions, the Sky Father is married to the Earth Mother. That's just something that is in every single one. Or the mother of the mountain, which Frigg is also known to be as Frau Hola. And yeah, Sonar says, and Legionary says, Nerthus, correct? Frigg is Nerthus that's my position on it. And
right, I would take the position that Frigg is different from Nerthus. I take the position that Frigg is Freya, but Nerthus is Freya's mother, which explains Njord. How you said have, right, is Njord's sister is Freya's mother. Freya and Freyr, both their mother is Nerthus, and that explains some of the confusions and the linguistic issues that we see when you know, we ascribe Frigg and Nerthus together.
Yeah, but Legionary says, "Who's saying such heresy?" It is, well, it's the typical actors, yeah. But here,
right, and here I do have the actual part from the Grimnismal I was talking about here, when Odin says about all of his various names, and I'd like to say that. He says, Sithhoth and Sithskeg, Sigfather and Nithkuth, Allfather, Valfather, Atrith, Farmatir, a single name have I never had since first among men I fared. Grimnir they call me in Geroth's hall, with Asmund Yalk am I. Kjallar I was when I went to a sledge, at the council Thror am I called, as Vithr I fare to the fight. Oski, Biflindi, Jafnhor, and Omi, Gondlir and Harbarth missed gods. Now am I Othin, Ig was I once, ere that they call me Thund, Vakan, Skilfing, Vofoth, and Hroptatir, Got and Yalk midst the gods, Ofnir and Svafnir, and all methinks are names for nuns but me.
That's incredible. I get the chills when I hear that kind of stuff, man. I love the edits. They're so beautiful. But
I brought that up because it was back at, you know, a couple of days ago when you asked what are our favorite passages from the sources, and that mm-hmm. was one of mine. That was my utter favorite.
I love it. Absolutely love it. And on my YouTube channel, I have a reading of the Havamal, if anybody is ever interested in that. But what I was going to point out about this theory about Odin being a construction or later addition or something like that. In every Indo-European tradition, the Sky Father is married to the Earth Mother. Frigg is the Earth Mother. And Frigg if you're like me and you attribute her to Nerthus, then Frigg goes back all the way. It's like she's like probably the oldest deity that we have evidence for. And if she goes back all the way, then therefore the Sky Father also goes back all the way, which means that Odin is among the oldest as well.
Right. I mean, they do appear to be generationally the same. We know that Njord and Nerthus are the sons of the goddess Nott and either Dagr or Delingard. It depends on the sources. And that was their father. And we don't really even have a further generation back than that. It just kind of goes off into nothing. So presumably that's kind of where the genealogy ends. Like first there was Delinger or Dagr, and then Nott and their kids were Njord and Nerthus.
Yeah. Incredible. Incredible. We're starting to run out of time.
Which is kind of like how Odin and his brothers Vili and Ve, their father is Bor and Vestla.
Absolutely. That's all stuff found in the Eddas. And if you're new to the faith, here, let me show you. I know I'm always shilling for Nirvana Society, but it's because I absolutely love it. And I wouldn't be working for them and working with them if I didn't absolutely believe 100% in their work. And I'm going to tell you, here's a book that has to be on your shelf if you're new to the faith. The Odinist Edda. This is the Eddas and a few other texts all put together into an epic, and it's really easy to read, and it's really easy to understand, and it's just really, really great stuff. And this even if you're just a fan of Germanic mythology and you want to do some reading and stuff, like, I have Christian friends that have this on their bookshelf, and they absolutely love it. You know, so the Odinist Edda, there's also the Ossetru Edda, but this is really great stuff.
Right, I do prefer the Odinist Edda myself because it preserves all the original Old Norse words and the actual, like, the original titles and whatnot. I don't think it's, you know, wrong to use the English version, but I do prefer the Old Norse myself.
Yeah. You're right, but I think you got the titles back. The Odinist Edda is the one that is more English friendly.
Oh, is it the Ossetru Edda? That's the Norse one.
Yep. Which they're both great. They're both great, as Tristan said. And
it's not a huge difference with whichever one you get. It's mostly just that very issue right there.
Yeah, that's I have multiple copies of both. The Ossetru Edda, long before I even, you know, knew Mark Perrier or knew the William Reeves or anybody of the guys in Nirvana Society, I've been giving copies of the Ossetru Edda out to members of my kindred since we've been together, which is like 6, 7, 8 years or whatever it is now. You know what I mean? So it's really, really great stuff. And Hugoder says, a religion is defined first and foremost by its scripture. If we're to take Ossetru seriously, we must start with the scripture as our base. What do you think about that, Tristan?
I think that's absolutely correct, and that is the basic fundamental tenet of Sethianism, that we approach the primary source documents as actual scripture and base everything upon that.
Yeah, 100%. It's called hierology. Hierology. If you don't have hierology, you don't have a religion. It's just what it is. So we are coming up on the end of time. To wrap it up on perennialism, any concluding comments about perennialism and maybe some ending arguments against it and why it's not conducive for somebody that is of authentic Germanic tradition?
Right. I mean, we did have one more source I wanted to get to, you know, the Ancients on Toleration here, but it is kind of long, so we might have to save it for some other time. But it does talk about how, very quickly, about how the Scythians, the Greeks, and the Romans did not allow religious syncretism as far as they could handle it. It also talks about Suetonius, the ancient writer, talks about how the Emperor Tiberius quote, zealously checked those practicing foreign rites, and on that account, Suetonius viewed him as a masterly governor. So this sort of ahistorical idea of the Romans as just being like these willy-nilly syncretists is actually wrong. That was considered almost a sort of heresy in their own time. It was not considered religiously orthodox or proper, even if it was popular.
Yeah, if you want to, also much love to Verbo. He says, "Hail the Bog!" Donated one diamond.
And again, we're gonna have to go over these lemons and diamonds and whatnot to figure out what that means. But however much that is, thank you very much.
Yeah, I'm not sure how much a lemon is.
Right, and to go on the idea of how it specifically cannot be compatible with the Germanic faith, we really do have to understand that perennialism in both, it doesn't matter which definition you're using here, both assume a sort of universal religious outlook that is incompatible with the folkish character of our religion. You cannot believe that there is a single God or a single religion for everyone and also be a Germanic heathen.
Just not possible.
No, it's not possible. It doesn't fit the metaphysics of our soul. It doesn't fit the documentation we have about what our people believed, what the Indo-European people believed.
Oh, I forgot about
Focus and especially if you're going to take a focused position. Oh.
Okay, so real quick before we
might want to end with his session there.
Yeah, we'll end it out with old Folkish Farmer. He's got a recipe for deer for us. He's gonna cook some deer, so don't go anywhere. We're gonna shut it out. But Mr. Tristan, any closing remarks?
No, I think that'll be it for me.
Wonderful. All right, very, very cool. So man, thank you so much, everybody, for coming and watching us here on D Live. This is our first time. I was pretty worried, you know, coming over to D Live from YouTube, and YouTube is a place I've been trying to build for a while and stuff like that ever since it kicked off Facebook and all that stuff. So I was pretty worried, but you know, I'm very, very happy with how this turned out, and I owe it all to all my friends here, man. All you guys that are tuning in this evening that came to check me out. Much love and many thanks to Rory and Mother Hen. Man, I love those two, man. They're such great people hosting it and helping me get some more views. And to all my homies, all said gang, rise up. Said gang, I know you guys are in the chat. I seen you. And much love to all my folk, all my folk and all my homies out there. And we're going to be back here next week, Thursday, 9 p.m. Eastern on DLive, Dave Martell channel, for another episode.
Right, we're all DLive all the time going forward.
Hell yeah. We are going to upload on YouTube. Like, you're still going to be able to find it on YouTube. As he said, gang, hell yeah. Rise up.
Right. We're just not going to be live on YouTube anymore.
Yeah. 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 It's going to be, well, I'll premiere it so people can kind of pretend that it's live. So there you can have that. There you go. So anyway, Legionary says, "Very interesting episode, fellas. Enlightening. Big hails. Two big brains bogging my mind as usual." Hell yeah. Very, very cool. All right, everybody. So I don't know if you got to subscribe or follow or whatever you do, but do the whole thing. Follow, like, subscribe, share, whatever you do here on DLive. We will be back here next week, Thursday, 9 p.m. Eastern, like always, every single week. We got a really great episode. It's lined up for you. You guys are going to really, really like it. More stuff coming. I'll see you guys very, very soon. Don't go anywhere. Folkish Farmer is going to cook a deer for you. So here we go with Folkish Farmer. Much love, many blessings, many hails. Hail the gods. Hail the folk and hail victory. I'll see you guys next week on the Bog.
Hello and welcome to the Kitchen of the Folkish Farmer. Today we're going to talk about deer. Deer are super important to our ancestors. Tacitus wrote in Germania in 23, "The drink is a liquor prepared from barley and wheat, brought fermentation to resemble that of wine. Those border on the Rhineland also purchased wine. wine was something that they enjoyed as well, but couldn't really grow. Their food is simple. It's wild fruits, fresh venison, and milk. They satisfy hunger without seeking the elegance and delicacies of that at the table. So Tacitus was talking about all these fancy foods from Rome. Now, deer is super important also with regards to what could be done with its bones, the hides, the antlers, and so on. In the Viking culture, specifically in Scandinavia, they made a lot of spoons and eating utensils out of the bones of the deer. Now, the Germanic people also did this as well. The Germanic people in continental Germany used a lot of the deer bones to create knife handles and so on. Deer is really woven into the fabric of our mythology as well. If you look at the Poetic Edda, the male red deer eats amongst the branches of the world tree, and there's actually several references to this. Also in Valhalla, there's a stag that is standing at the presence of the divine in Valhalla as well. So deer is something that's super important to our people, and I wanted to give you guys today a very simple recipe. A lot of people are intimidated by deer. I hear it all the time. Well, it has a very gamey flavor, those kind of things. We're going to take that gamey flavor out. We're going to Okay, guys, I just brought this back from browning it up. It's got a really nice brown look here to it. Looks very good. So what I've got in here is celery, carrots, onions, and apples with garlic. So I've got that already chopped up in here. I'm going to go ahead and dump this in here. And the nice thing about using cast iron is it does stay relatively warm, so that I can kind of saute this around a little bit before I add anything else to it. So I'm just going to kind of add that in there and let that kind of cook down. Cast iron will retain some heat. That's why I like using cast iron a lot. So I'm going to put this back. Now, the next thing that I'm going to do is I'm going to add some port, or I'm going to add some red wine. It doesn't really matter. I use wonderful cheap Porto. You can get this for like $10, $15. It's extremely cheap. I just want to use about that much. So if you're wondering, it's probably about 3/4 a cup, something like that. So what I'm going to do now is I'm going to add 2 or 3 bay leaves. So I got 2 there. Add 1 more bay leaf in there. And then I'm going to add some juniper berries. Juniper berries are used a lot in German cooking, so I'm going to add about 5 juniper berries there. You don't want to add too many, or you'll end up tasting like basically a juniper plant, but you do want to give it that nice aromatic flavor. And then the next ingredient that I'm going to put in here is some cinnamon. Cinnamon will give it a nice warm flavor, probably about maybe a teaspoon of cinnamon. Just kind of get that all through there. And I put a little bit on top of the meat as well. And then I'm going to add back a little bit more salt into it here. Now, at this point, what I'm going to do is I'm going to add the bone broth. I've had bone broth cooking pretty much all week. If you guys have been listening to the way I cook, I pretty much have bone broth going at all times. So this is actually from lamb bones, but it really doesn't matter. It could be from beef bones, chicken bones, whatever. It's just going to give it a nice flavor. So what I'm going to do is take my little strainer here. Just going to kind of put it right over this right here so that I don't get any large chunks or anything like that. You have to kind of move the meat over a little bit, but it's fine. Right there. And then I'm just going to pour some of this broth directly to that strainer so it catches any kind of chunks. And I'm going to fill this up pretty much till it covers all but just a little portion of the meat there. Good. Put this back on to continue simmering for the rest of the week. Add this in here. What's nice is that whatever you captured there, just dump it right back in. No problem. Leave that there. Just go ahead and kind of chop up the rest of these little pieces here. Just throw those in there. Now, while chopping this up, essentially what you're going to do with this is you're going to put it in the oven at 325 for about 8 hours. And yes, you did hear me right on that, about 8 hours. The reason being is deer does not have a lot of fat on it. Deer is one of the leanest animals that I have ever seen in my entire life. One thing that could be leaner is possibly elk, and it's in the same family. So what we're going to do from here now is we're going to take this, we're going to put it uncovered in the oven at 325 for about 8 hours. Once that's done, I'll show you guys what it looks like. And thanks for watching.